Yeah, my heavens indeed. Welcome back, everybody. 8:17 on this Wednesday morning with J.R. Simmer and Hammer. Some highlights from around the National Hockey League last night, including Matt Murray's big night for the Leafs. Got a shutout. Mitch Marner's point streak extended. Shane Wright. If you were to draw it up for Shane Wright and say, who do you want to score your first NHL goal against? I would say Montreal probably, based on the draft, would be at the top of the list. Well, that's what happened last night. Although, the Habs get the last laugh because they win the game 4-2. Meanwhile, here in Ottawa, the Sens, after a couple of encouraging victories from the weekend, stub their toe, as it were, last night in a 5-2 loss to the Los Angeles Kings. And now they head out on the road with their dads for a pair of games starting tomorrow night in Dallas and continuing Saturday in Nashville. Let's bring into the proceedings our next guest. He is our TSN hockey analyst, presentation of the Myers Automotive Group. We say hello and good morning to Dave Poulin. How are you doing this morning, Dave?
I'm doing well, gentlemen, but I was really thinking about the word momentum, and the word momentum doesn't carry itself. You have to still play. And, you know, sometimes it's a little bit deceiving for a team when they play as well as they did in both New York and back at home on Saturday, and you think that is going to carry the mail in the next game, and it simply didn't, and there wasn't a preparedness to play that game. And two goals in the first, you know, two-plus minutes that are both just breakdowns. And the hard part about a breakdown for me, it's an individual breakdown, and it's on your first shift. And, you know, you think about your first shift all day. I mean, you're going to have a first shift of the game, and it drives a coach crazy when there's a small technical error that says, you know, Alex DeBrincat doesn't pick up, you know, a Matt Roy. This isn't like it's not like a focus on an Erik Karlsson coming in from the point. It's Matt Roy, and he doesn't pick him up. And then the next one is a line change. The next one's a little more of a challenge, but it's a line change. And you're going on the ice for the first time, and all three Senator forwards change. It's a one-on-two. All three Senator forwards change, and Parker Kelly beats his guy off on the change, and then Kostelec beats his guy off on the change. And the third player, Blake Lizotte, coming off the LA bench, simply beats Austin Watson off the bench. Just pure off the bench change, be ready to go. And that's what sets up the second goal. So 2.5 minutes, you're down two, and against a goaltender that the last thing you wanted to do is give Phoenix Copley a lead, guys. I mean, no one had seen him in a couple of years. And, you know, as a 30-year-old who's played 31 games in the National Hockey League, and you light up when you see a guy like that going into play against you, and that's dangerous. And they never got off the mark.
Is that more on the Sens' slow start last night? And you pointed out some individual errors. So is that on the players, do you think? Or is that on, it's always a combination thereof, but is it on more on the players or more on the coach? DJ Smith said afterward, that's on me. I didn't have my players prepared, obviously, by the way they opened the game.
I don't agree with that. I think that's absolutely on the players. Those are two veteran players. And it's not like that's a straight up play, JR. That's a, you know, when you're covering a point, that's your guy. There was no switching going on. There was no three forwards high confusion as to who I have. That was a defenseman beating you to the net for a rebound on the first one. In the second one, line changes are something that should be practiced much more than they are. And so you're going to say, well, is that a coaching thing? It's not for a veteran like Austin Watson. I mean, you're looking, you're watching your guy come, and you watch the change, and it's a slow change. And you've got to explode onto the ice for a change. You've got to start playing your shift before your shift starts. You're watching your right winger out there, and you're watching where he is on the ice. You're watching what the scenario is on the other side. The other side changed all their forwards. I mean, it's a one-on-two, and everything is fine. You can't get beat off the bench. That's not a coaching thing. That's an NHL player who's been around a long time, and you've got to be ready to play your first shift of the game.
And I believe Pooley, he had flat starts, but structure and goaltending save you at times because it does happen. But for the Ottawa Senators under DJ Smith, it has not been, and I agree with you, the slow start, but overall structure has been an issue. And what gives? Is it personnel issue? Is it coaching? Because we've seen this for three-plus years now.
Would you put either of those first two goals on structure, Simmer?
Well, again, that's a great point. On DeBrincat, you have to be better. So, again, I guess I say from a structure standpoint, I guess I go back to a teaching element. Austin Watson, you know, slow reaction, normally has a good work ethic. But in the case of DeBrincat, we've seen this affair. I guess it's been repetitive, I guess, more than anything, Pooley, is that it's not the first time that these players, not Watson, but DeBrincat and others, are not making the same mistakes.
Right. But that's on the individual to me. I mean, that's, you know, that's a guy that you expect to be able to make that play there. And he, from a structure standpoint, you're in good position to make the play. You simply don't make the play. And that's not a breakdown in structure. That's a breakdown in an individual not making a play. So I think those two words kind of get confused sometimes. Mm-hmm. It's still up to individuals on the ice to be able to make a play.
There was a little bit of debate, I think, about they did eventually take Cam Talbot in after the fifth goal, and there's some debate, should it have come maybe a little bit earlier, maybe after the fourth goal or whatever. What did you think about, you know, first of all, the decision to use the timeout after the second goal early in the game, and then also the decision basically on what is the right time, if any, to lift the goalie?
Well, start with the timeout decision. I was fine with it, and one night, when I was coaching in college, there was an NHL general manager at my game, and I asked him about it because I called a timeout early in the game. And he said, look, I'm not down on the bench. He said, you have a feel for it. You're down on the bench. And it was a similar situation, which I called a timeout early. And he said, I will never question when my coach calls his timeout. I will question if a coach has a timeout left at the end of the game, and I thought he could have used it somewhere. And I thought that was an interesting distinction. And so he takes it at 2-0. And the thought there is, it wasn't like you were being swarmed. It was two individual breakdowns. If I'm being swarmed and it's 2-0, I don't want to take a timeout there because I don't want to build momentum for the other team and have them on the bench chirping up that they're swarming us. They weren't swarming Ottawa at that point. It was simply 2-0. So I'm fine with that timeout. It's 2-0. And he could have pulled the goalie at that point, but that would have been a message to his team that, you know, there's someone's going to pay the price for it, and it's the goalie, and it's not his fault. He chose not to do that. I'm fine with that. And I'm fine with it at 4-0 because there was another line change. The Arvidsson goal was again coming off the bench on a line change. And so two of the four goals were on line changes, and, you know, that's not on the goalie. He gets beat over his glove side. Now, you may want to save there, and that's a difference. But after the fifth one, you know, he made the decision. He didn't like that goal. It goes through him. And he said, look, it's not your night. You know, we're going to go in with Forsberg at this point. So, you know, kind of three different stopping points on that decision, and I'm fine with it.
Yeah, it's such a small critique, Pooley, but I'd argue the other side of Talbot didn't look sharp. The team wasn't sharp. When I'm still at the four spot, I still feel like I'm in a game. When you allowed to go through the first intermission and he lets in a weak one for the fifth one, your night's over. That's the time to me you end up making the change, is at the fourth. And again, I don't look at it ever being personal. You had your goals properly. Forsberg stood on his head on Saturday night. You get him in there after the fourth one.
Yeah, you could. You could, Simmer. I would agree. I wouldn't have done it after two,
yeah.
And I might have done it after four.
Hmm. One thing that, from a positive point of view, the Sens power play is really rocking right now. Thomas Chabot now has 4 power play goals this season. He had 3 in his career going into this year, but just overall really seems to be humming. What's the secret, do you think?
I think it's quick puck movement and movement of personnel. And in the first one, we broke down the first one, and Stützle is up at the top. And when you get guys moving like that, dangerous guys moving like that, it's so hard for the penalty killers because you're sorting out where they're going to be. And if you think of where Stützle was, he was essentially in 3 different places on that goal. He was kind of in the middle, then he was at the top in the middle, and then he eventually gets the shot off the half wall. But and I know Simmer's been, you know, been pining for DeBrincat to be on that offside. That's his best position. I mean, clearly, the offside on the half wall. And that's where he has to be the most productive. And they've tried different variations of what it was, and, you know, and ironic on a day when Josh Norris comes back and skates and you get the temptation of remembering that half wall, you know, slap shot and how effective that was on just this, what this could look like. But I think one of the things you're seeing is Thomas Chabot getting more comfortable at the top and with that group, with that exact group, with DeBrincat, because that's an outside pass on that play. And I say an outside pass, yeah, both. So in the middle, you got a picture for me here. In the middle, Chabot's a left shot. DeBrincat's a right shot on the half wall. So that pass is outside the line of any stick, and that's why that's effective. If you have a left shot where DeBrincat is, in a Timmy Stützle, that's an inside-to-outside pass. And so it's a little bit easier to defend if I'm a penalty killer. I'm not getting too technical on you here, JR.
I got my radio telestrator out right now. I'm following along, no problem.
Sometimes I say things on the radio and I'm like, I can't describe that well enough. But you're just outside the box and the passing lane is cleaner from a right shot to a left shot, which enables Shabbat to shoot the puck easier.
Maybe I got spoiled back in the day, Pooley, watching the Caps and watching Adam Oates. But again, I just look at hockey 101. It shouldn't be that hard. Anybody that's played the game, when I have an elite passer as a right shot, the difference of, first of all, DeBrincat, we also talked about, hey, let's not hit ourselves. Him being a shooting threat also helps. But Thomas Shabbat now, as they freeze everybody, as you said, the comfort level of a right shot versus a left shot is everything, not to mention it is opening up the shooting lane because people are backing off on DeBrincat.
It's a cleaner lane for sure. What you take away is you take away the effectiveness of that pass down to the below the goal line. And, you know, because if you make that pass from a left shot to a right shot, then that's an easier pass to the bumper position. So you can go on both sides on it for sure. And I think effective power plays have a lot of movement, and it's not a setup. Teams scout too well. They watch video. They break things down so well that you have to have a lot of movement on that. You can't be in one position all the time.
How ornery will the Dallas Stars be tomorrow night when the Sens come to town based on their 4-0 loss to the Leafs last night?
They were handled pretty well by Toronto last night, and Toronto guys is playing as well defensively maybe as they've played in this recent, you know, whatever, 4, 5, 6 years. They've played it in spots, but they haven't played this consistently, this well defensively. And they had no choice. They were so undermanned back there. I mean, their top defenseman right now, arguably, is a 39-year-old Mark Giordano, who's terrific. And, you know, so they're playing really well as a team, and that's what Dallas had to deal with last night. And Dallas is a good team, and they play a hard game, and they've been getting great goaltending from Ottinger as well. But, yeah, it will be, you know, the hardest thing to do right now, guys, is look at the schedule and trying to figure out what's going to be easy and what's going to be hard. It just is. And, you know, you look at it, Montreal steps out west and goes 2-1-1, you know, in the northwest swing, if you will, out west, and beats a Seattle team that's been red hot and is very effective out there. So it's hard to play the schedule game. And we talked about how this schedule for Ottawa kind of jumps all over the place, but everybody's just jumping all over the place right now. You know, teams come home and play one game, then they go on the road for three, and then they come back and play one. And it seems really disjointed, and particularly with who you're playing, you can't guess on where your wins and losses are.
The easiest way to pick the wins is by FanDuel. I use my app every night. to that, Pooley, I love the dad sing, and I don't think there's any distraction whatsoever. Do you not also expect on the other side that the Sens are going to come out and play great against Dallas?
I'm picturing some of the rides home with some of those dads as kids, okay? When, you know, I can you picture Big Walt after Brady was really not very good one night? Like, I'm not thinking there's a lot said on the way home. I'm not thinking that's a really chirpy ride. And so it's kind of funny when you're sitting with your dad now instead on a chartered jet and he's asking you questions. The guys that are doing it for the first time, it was always so much fun to watch. The dad's doing it for the first time. And the way their eyes lit up, and I would sit up near the front of the plane in management, the way the dad's eyes would light up when they stepped onto that plane, guys, and they saw the way their sons travel for the first time, and then they sit with their dads on the plane, that part of it alone is has to bring flashbacks of the rides home from the cold rinks at night when you didn't play very well. So it's a trip that absolutely you are incentivized in every way. Now, I'm not sure which ones put more pressure on them. It may be the mom's trip that puts a little more pressure on them than the dad's trip, depending on who was doing the majority of the driving to the rink.
Do you feel like, based on the driving, that Walt would have been a reach in the back seat, Dad, hey, as the kids are fighting?
I think that's a pretty long arm, but I think he let them figure it out for themselves.
Oh, that's a good point. Good point.
Yeah, I think he let them figure it out. And I think the daughter was, in fact, in the mix as well. Like, I think she took her odd shot going by in the kitchen, too.
How much would Shane Wright have enjoyed scoring that goal against Montreal last night? Is that storyline a bit overblown, or do you think that there is a little bit something to it?
Oh, I think there's something to it for sure. You know, he was the incumbent number one for so long in that draft. And, you know, as Slavkovsky emerged as the pick that Montreal was going to take, absolutely. And then to fall to number four. And then for it to not go well. But I think he got back the track a little bit, guys, when he went down to Coachella Valley, which would be a pretty nice place to go for 2 weeks in early December. And I think he got back on track a little bit. He scored a couple goals, got a little confidence back. I would assume, by all indications, he's on his way to the World Juniors. And that would be a good confidence booster scoring against Montreal, albeit in a loss on your way to the World Juniors.
Would you send Slavkovsky to the World Junior?
No, I think that's a different situation.
How come, Bully?
He's so far removed from it. You know, he's been up the whole year. He's far removed. He's starting to play up a little bit more in the lineup. Simmer, they've been pretty calculated with how they use him, even within a game. When I'm watching a game, he starts in the fourth line, and then you watch, and there's two shifts up on the second line late in the second period. And I think that's a slower progression, but it's a steady one, and I think they're fine with the way things are going.
The Winnipeg Jets, it was interesting seeing some of the post-game reaction after they beat Florida last night 5-2, and of course Paul Maurice's first game back since he left the Jets, I guess it was a year or so ago now. Mark Scheifele, he said, hey, no hiding it from me. That game was extra special to me. What do you think is the real story of what went down? Was that just a relationship that just went on too long in terms of Maurice and the long-term players for the Jets, or what?
Yeah, I think Paul Maurice was very accurate when he thought at that point that the players need another voice. Well, what does that do? That immediately throws the heat at the players, guys. And, you know, and I don't think he walked away from them. I think he thought he was doing the right thing for the organization. I think there was a loyalty there on both sides of the organization. I mean, they don't change coaches a lot in Winnipeg. They're very loyal to the people they choose. That ownership group is an incredibly loyal ownership group. And, you know, so it was the coach that made that decision. And when he did that, by the way, that shone the light pretty harshly on that group. And I think that group took a lot of heat over the summer. You know, it didn't go well after Paul Maurice left. And there were a lot of questions. Obviously, a new coach came in. He changed the captain right away. And it put the magnifying glass on those guys. And by the way, they've responded in a big way. And so if you look at it from Paul Maurice's standpoint, it probably was the right move for him to step down and for there to be a new voice in there. And they appear to have the proper new voice in Rick Bowness. But from a standpoint of the player, when you get the light turned on you that brightly, I'm sure there's a lot of satisfaction in that for Mark Scheifele. I don't think there's a wrong or a bad in any of this, but I think it's pretty prominent that you know, those guys, they were feeling huge heat going into this year for sure to perform and to be the team that for the last couple of years everybody thought they were going to be.
Well, coaching changes work. Montgomery, Cassidy, DeBoer, you know, you go Rick Bowness for that matter.
Well, you and I have talked about that though, Simmer. That's a case of, in those cases, you know, that Bruce Cassidy wasn't fired because of his performance. It was fired. That was the new voice question, and in Vegas as well. And arguably it was in Dallas as well. Dallas was in the finals 2 years ago. But that's the layer of coaching when you go from a good guy to a good guy that you benefit from both guys. Because, you know, Dallas is still benefiting from what Rick Bowness told guys in certain situations. And now Pete DeBoer is telling them something a little added to that. So that's a compounding effect. And in Boston, I think, is a great example of that. You know, a compound effect of what happens in that situation.
Did Florida make the right decision letting Andrew Brunette go and bringing in Paul Maurice?
Boy, that'll play out, won't it? Because
that's not an answer.
No. Oh, it is an answer. Oh, it is an answer. Okay. When I'm asked an either or, I say yeah.
Okay.
It's an answer because it's going to play out, guys.
Yeah, true. That I know. Yeah.
And I think Andrew Brunette's going to be a very good coach in the National Hockey League. I think he's going to pick his next spot. And maybe best not to jump right into something because there were opportunities. And I think he'll pick his next spot very carefully. And by the way, he's landed in a pretty good place in Jersey to learn from a Lindy Ruff. I mean, who knows what the succession plan was talked about in that situation. But he certainly landed in a good place contributing. And sometimes when you're a head coach and you go back to being an associate as Andrew has, you benefit that much more because his landing as a head coach was a total surprise to him. And a lot of that reaction through the course of the year was, you know, this was all the first time that he was sitting in that seat on the bus. I think he's going to be a good coach for a long time. And Florida has to get squared away for it to look like the right move.
on the opposite side, coaches on the hot seat. There's a survey out this morning on ESPN.com about NHL coaches on the hot seat, and there's four listed, three of which we've talked about extensively in Bruce Boudreau, Dallas Eakins, and DJ Smith here in Ottawa. The fourth name is Gerard Gallant with the New York Rangers. Do you believe there's some substance to the fact that they may make a move on the coach potentially?
Well, that one's a total wild card because of the impatience of the organization and the expectations this year. That was supposed to be a top team coming in. The goalie hasn't been the same as he was last year, which masked a lot of stuff. But just watching Jacob Trouba the last couple games, his antics and his actions, there's something going on there that we're not seeing. And so, that ownership group is capable of doing whatever.
Yeah. Yes. James Dolan, absolutely. All right, we'll leave it there. Thanks for the time, as always, Dave, and look forward to chatting with you again on Friday.
Thanks, guys. Have a great day.
How's it going, Aaron Judge? Welcome back, everybody. 8:44 on this Wednesday morning. J.R. Simmer and Hammer Sens fall 5-2 to the Kings. They're in Dallas coming up tomorrow. Much more in the game. More your reaction coming up here on the show. We'll talk some World Cup as well. First off day since the tournament began. I got some football stuff for you as well, including news of an Ottawa Red Black on a tryout with in the NFL. So we'll go through all of that, but more detail just announced, not officially by the Yankees, but all the baseball insiders have it, that Aaron Judge is going back to the New York Yankees. It's a 9-year contract for $360 million. I'll do the math for you because it's nice and round. $40 million per season for Aaron Judge, which makes him the highest paid position a player in Major League Baseball at $40 million. Got a couple of pitchers who are making more than that. Matt Scherzer and Justin Verlander are both at $43 million, both on shorter term deals with the New York Mets. But Aaron Judge becomes the highest paid position player at $40 million per season, going back to the New York Yankees.
Yeah, and I guess that decision, Jer, at the end of the day, not that you're looking at taxes, but half of that's going to the government, whether you're in California or New York. And then I guess at the end of the day, do you really want to go home, or do you want to stay on the top of the castle playing for one of the most prominent sports franchises in the world? And when you've had success like that, as you said, not many people turn that down, right? That say, hey, you know what? This isn't for me. So hey, good for him. I'm one of the most likable athletes on the planet.
Is Aaron Judge the center of I'm thinking that I don't see him a lot in terms of commercial endorsements. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not like his face is plastered everywhere, or maybe I'm just missing it.
Well,
like Mike Trout is the most anonymous superstar in all of sports, and that's the way that Mike Trout wants it to be. He doesn't want to do ads. He doesn't want to do any of that stuff. He just wants to play baseball, and that's all well and fine. But I don't, Aaron Judge he could sell a lot of whatever it is that he endorses, but am I right, Hammer? Do you see him in a lot of stuff?
I think you're right. I think he's just another one of those quiet superstars, and he's such a large figure on the diamond itself. I mean, he doesn't really need to go out there and sell himself, so I'm sure he takes a little bit of pride in that he doesn't have to go shill whatever products that are being thrown at him. Because he's a larger-than-life athlete right now, as it is.
Yeah, certainly Tom Brady uses the same formula.
Yeah, he's really quiet.
His commercials are interesting to say that, Jared, because I also feel like Aaron Judge would be a very good Conan the Barbarian. He's kind of a bit of an Arnold, and he's much brighter than Arnold, and Arnold couldn't speak English. But he doesn't need to talk. You just need to show him, and I mean that sincerely as a baseball player. But also, as you mentioned that, JR, and it's funny because, well, we had conversations yesterday talking about different sports and how, whatever, I'll leave that conversation. But from a marketing standpoint, no, I know, but in marketing standpoint, JR, in Canada now, the basketball players for the Raptors have chewed up almost all the advertising. And when I also think of the
United States. Scotty Barnes has.
Well, you're right. But even Fred has a little something, and I saw somebody else, or maybe Scotty was shaving too. But what I'd ask in the United States, like, it feels like Shaquille O'Neal still holds. And this, to my point is the basketball player the most marketed athlete brand in the United States versus football, or am I looking way past that?
No, I think, the NBA has always celebrated the superstar. Whenever a game they're promoting a game coming up on the weekend, it's always LeBron James and the LA Lakers taking on Luka Doncic and the Dallas Mavericks. It's never the Lakers and the Mavericks. It's always superstar player, whatever it is, always gets the more prominent.
But the quarterback in the NFL gets that as well. Like, it's Tom Brady and Patrick Mahomes. Like,
yeah,
they don't just
for
say
sure.
So it's quarterbacks, I guess, my point. But it's just in trying to reach the demographics in the United States, guys, it has to be certainly hockey doesn't have the profile, but there must be a little something with baseball. And then I guess the other part, and it's not the same buildup it used to be, but certainly the basketball, the visibility of the player because he doesn't wear a helmet, and just familiarity with him, even from college on, JR. Like, it just, yeah, they're so recognizable because it's like, oh, there he is. Where with a football player, I know everybody knows the quarterbacks, but after the quarterback, do you really know what many guys look like? So, yeah, there were kind of a real interesting discussion. And on Aaron Judge, like, you would think, and this is also for if he was going to make a ton of cash, I guess, also, you don't have to go much further than your own market, right? He doesn't need national advertising to make a lot of dough.
Well, and that's why that was the basis of my point is that Aaron Judge remaining, if making even more money, is a big deal to him. Being in New York puts your face and your mug in front of a lot more people than it does in San Francisco.
Oh, so, and he's just so marketable, right? I mean, you know, what's not to
the
like?
The most prominent franchise in the game. And the biggest city. And the franchise plays in the biggest city, and that's where all the advertising comes out of. Like, it makes so much sense if he decides to go down that road to an even larger extent. And as I said, there's just nothing that pops to mind when I think of Aaron Judge endorsing things.
Which is weird because doing a little research here, he does have quite a few endorsements, and I don't know how he's going about it. Maybe it's just through a social media team, but Hulu, Adidas, Pepsi, Jersey Mike's, I've never seen him in a Jersey Mike's ad. Bloomingdale's, Oakley, T-Mobile, Fanatics, we've seen that just through the Yankees wear. Tops, Franklin.
I guess if you're using the products, as you're saying, Hammer, versus necessarily advertising, and again, kind of speaking to the power of the NBA, Michael Jordan, now he works for a team, you think of the documentary, but it's amazing the power that Shaquille and Chuck still have as TV announcers here, right? Like, I know the announcers are popular, but and I guess even, say, Tony Romo, right? I mean, he's Howie Long. I mean, who doesn't want to get Skechers after watching that? I know even you went out and got a pair of JR.
Exactly. Very light on the feet. Absolutely. Yeah. All right. Biggest pay packets, Major League Baseball players. Mike Trout, $426 million, but it's a 12-year contract. So he's got to make do at $35.5 million a year. Mookie Betts, $365 million over 12 years. So he's a shade over $30 million with the Dodgers. Francisco Lindor, $341 million. With the Mets. Fernando Tatis, $340 million over 14 years with the Padres. Bryce Harper, $330 million over 13 years with the Phillies. I think the next big one that's out there, it's going to be interesting to see whether he may potentially exceed Aaron Judge, although what remains to be seen is Juan Soto, because he's due to become a free agent in a couple of years. He's going to be at that point, 26 years old, I believe it is. If you want to talk about... a tremendous athlete in their prime. I just don't know that he has that big bopper sort of feel that Aaron Judge does.
Was he suspended this year, or am I missing it?
No, you're thinking of somebody else.
Oh.
Aaron Judge, I don't think he has that same persona, but just in terms of raw athletic ability, like a lot of people are thinking that Juan Soto could potentially be in the running, depending on how long he plays, of setting the Major League home run record. Like,
this is
how big a star this guy potentially could be.
Yeah, I'm sorry. He was one traded from. I was thinking of the fellow that plays for San Diego that ended up getting suspended.
Fernando Tatis.
Yeah, and to that, JR, is also interesting from a standpoint of these contracts getting done. What also I think is very relatable in baseball, guys, is that, the rumor in the NBA is always they want the big markets, but I think these players can travel anywhere. In football, everything is mass marketed, and wherever Tom Brady, and this is a great example, goes for it, is going to be fine. In the case of baseball, those regional contracts are so big that it has to be a huge factor in the Yankees keeping a star player like that. And the simple fact that Yes Network is saying, listen, we're doing 162 of these. Can't let the biggest star on the planet leave, right?
Yep, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. And you're looking north of the border here with these big contracts where the Blue Jays, Vladdy Guerrero, can be a free agent in 2025.
Yeah, he's got 3 more years.
3 more years. So you don't make it to 2025, usually around this point, maybe 2 years left, you start buying up some of those free agent years.
Right.
So you're wondering when that is going to happen for the Blue Jays, and you'll have Bo Bichette as well. I was trying to
find
numbers,
out. Vladdy, is Vladdy over $30 million a year?
Right now?
Yeah.
If you were to sign him? A little dip last year. I think if you could get him at $30 million, to be quite honest, I think that'd be a steal. If I'm Vladdy, I wouldn't be signing long term yet. Coming off of that year,
I think he's easy over $30 million because I think he's getting that on the open market if he got it that far. And if the Blue Jays want to get ahead of the game, they're going to have to pay up. There's no doubt about that because I think he's his personality, his smile, the you know, his general joy for the game and everything. I mean, I think that helps sell the entire thing as well. So I there's no doubt in my mind that if he doesn't get in Toronto, he's getting it somewhere else. He's going to get a monster contract.
He's going to get it in Toronto. You can't let somebody like if he wants it in Toronto.
Yeah, and don't forget what he did at the Home Run Derby. Was that 2-3 years ago now, when he hit the 90 home runs or whatever it was? Like, that's the type of stuff that puts you on the map. Does he play, you know, in terms of an American baseball fan, in a bit of a backwater in Toronto? He does. Certainly a big one here in Canada, but less so in the United States. But those are the types of moments that put you on the map with the average baseball fan, that they know who you are and what you're all about.
Yeah, it didn't hurt having a dad, but yeah, you look at Boston, you look at, you know, the teams, and Boston maybe returning to that. Now, I guess the only part with Vladdy, guys, from under the hood from the Blue Jays, is just making sure you're totally comfortable that he's totally committed, that he's going to kind of stay the path here from a work ethic standpoint and everything else. But at the same time, you probably have no choice. As you said, all the things you just mentioned, that they have kind of built that franchise around him. He is the face of the Toronto Blue Jays.
They're not paying somebody else. That's the thing with superstars.
Yeah, for sure.
Right?
For sure.
They know.
Yeah.
They know that.
Yeah. And I think he's shown his commitment to fitness now the last couple of seasons. When you start stringing years together of being fit and being healthy and playing through an entire season, now that they moved him to first base, winning Gold Gloves at first base too, after not having much of a history at that position. It says a lot about the kind of athlete that Vlady Guerrero is.
So the term is betting on yourself, and Aaron Judge did that in the spring when he turned down the Yankees' offer of 7 years and $210 million, $30 million a year. He just signed for 9 years and $360 million. So he's making
himself...
Where's
that ball, too? Now that he's a Yankee and staying a Yankee?
Yeah.
Does the value of that ball jack up a little bit, too, now?
Yeah, that's a great question. The home run ball, that is, I believe the auction is on, I think it ends sometime in the next few days now. For the 60-second home run ball.
Do they have a live tally? Can we see what the current bidding is? Or
well, it's at Sotheby's.
Silent?
And in the catalog, it's kind of interesting when they market it. They have the three baseballs, then they have the three Fabergé eggs that they do not want to have. That'll be really interesting, though, right, guys? Like, I just, you know, that's something real cool on to whether or not it means anything to the athlete, or certainly out there.
Got the money to pay for it if he wants it.
Yeah, and I do think Hammer... because there's so much money in New York. Now, one side could say, well, it was his last time with New York, but the fact he stays in New York and maybe you run into him, and I'm assuming you want to get the ball signed, I think that would help. Or do you sign the ball, or does that take away the value? Anybody know?
You know, that's an interesting question. I don't know if I'd want it signed, to be quite honest.
No?
Well, you definitely don't want it signed to Bob. Thanks for catching it. The little I know about memorabilia, if you're getting something signed... Yeah. And you eventually may, you even thinking about that you want to sell it one day, okay. Don't put your own name on it.
That's an excellent point. And if I'm Aaron Judge, I'm not signing it if it's not mine. I want it to be mine. If somebody else buys it.
What if the guy says, I'll give you $100,000?
No way, not a chance.
What?
How about you give me the ball and I'll give you some.
By the time this guy spent that much money,
some cool fantasy
he's going to pay to go to some Aaron Judge meet and greet with one of the big places in New York, and he'll get it. Now, I say this, like, I think about Ted Williams, his poor situation, JR, where his son on his deathbed had him signing baseballs. I got to think that helps in the fact that you got it signed by Aaron Judge, no?
I just don't think if I'm Aaron Judge, I'm signing that ball.
Really? Okay.
No way. See you later. I'll think of a nice little package we can put together, and we'll hang out. And you can just give that ball to me, please, and thank you.
It will be interesting to find out if the Yankees buy him the ball as part of this contract, or he turns around and buys the ball. The latest estimates were that it would be worth, the guy turned down $3 million, was it?
Yeah, okay. That was the report.
Yeah, and the thinking was that, obviously, if you turn down $3 million, you think you're getting more than that. But whatever that number might be, obviously, Aaron Judge can more than afford on a $360 million contract if it means that much to him to buy it.
I also think the Yankees, after handing out the contract here, I don't need any gift packages.
You know, but maybe it's 300. My point is, maybe it's $355 million and the ball.
Well, and ownership standpoint, which, you know, Yankees, I guess, is still Steinbrenner. But is there somebody really wealthy out there that wants to buy the ball and gift it to him? That'll be interesting as well.
Which takes us back to, was it the 61st home run ball that was hit in Toronto? Oh, the tying one that landed in the bullpen?
Yes, the tying one.
And the Blue Jays bullpen, pitching coach or whatever, is the guy that ended up with it?
That's right, bullpen coach.
Aaron Judge ended up with number 60 and number 61.
The young fellas there, the college kids gave it to him in New York State. Was it at Yankee Stadium?
That was at Yankee.
Yeah.
So, and one of the kids, you knew it was a giveaway. He had a Judge t-shirt on.
Yes, indeed. Anyway, there you go. There's your breaking news from this morning. Aaron Judge re-signs with the Yankees for 9 years, $360 million. So if you're a Blue Jay fan,
he's not coming to Toronto.
No, he was never coming to Toronto, but I guess my point is,
that's 81 games. He'll be in Toronto for, six?
He's a very popular athlete, but he's also a very good baseball player. Not only hits home runs, but he's a tremendous defensive fielder as well. Like, that makes the Yankees a much stronger team, having Aaron Judge than not having Aaron Judge. Sometimes superstars can... There's a lot more hype than there is substance, and you're kind of, at the end of the day, with how much money they spend on a certain player, it's like you probably could have spent less money and been a better team. Mm-hmm. I think with Aaron Judge, I think even though $40 million is a crazy amount of money, I think that's probably an appropriate amount for Aaron Judge and what he brings to the table.
Yeah, and you wonder if Leaper is going to lose his job as the outfield coach.
That's a good point.
I'm assuming
base running and outfield
quality control. He was designated with landing this guy.
8:59. We'll take a break. Thoughts on anything we converse about is always welcome. You can text us at 12-1200. Tweet at us at TSN1200. We'll take a break. Top of the hour update is upcoming next hour. More on the Sens and Kings as the Sens get set to hit the road for a pair of games starting in Dallas tomorrow against the Stars. So we'll go through all of that. It's football news as well. We're making our way toward 10 o'clock. And in the box, coming up next hour as well, chance for you to win tickets. There's some of the very best women hockey players in the world will be in Ottawa this weekend. It's the PWHPA All-Star Challenge happening this weekend at Canadian Tire Center. We got a chance for you to win tickets coming up next hour as well, right here on Sports Radio TSN 1200.